planet that's got so much oxygen in its atmosphere. And now these guys are not believers, and they came up immediately with a connection. It's got to have something to do with advanced life. And in their paper, they talk about what you need in the way of oxygen for advanced life. And they're all chemists. And so they look at the atomic chart, you know, with its 100-plus elements. And what they notice is there's only three elements in the atomic chart that are really efficient at the delivering large amounts of free energy when they're reduced chemically. And that would be oxygen, fluorine, and chlorine. So those are three elements that will deliver huge amounts of energy when they're reduced. And everything else in the atomic chart delivers trivial amounts. Only oxygen, chlorine, and fluorine will deliver large amounts. But the problem with chlorine and fluorine is that it reacts so readily with almost anything. I mean, those of you that have took chemistry classes, I'm sure were warned by your professors to really watch out for fluorine. In fact, I remember when I was taking chemistry, one of my fellow students was pipetting fluoric acid. Now, fluoric acid is so corrosive that it'll corrode glass. You can't keep it in a beaker. You've got to keep it in a special wax container because it just eats through anything. And here is this guy pipetting this. He would have been dead on the spot if he hadn't pipetted it just perfectly. But he thought he was pipetting some quite safe fluid. Thought it was just kind of a water solute. And then he was told, by the way, do you realize what you're pipetting? And that's the problem with chlorine, too. Those, most of you are aware just how corrosive, say, hydrochloric acid is. Or chlorine gas. Chlorine gas is what was used in World War I to kill soldiers on the battlefield. Very corrosive. You release it in the atmosphere and it corrodes right away. Same thing with fluorine. It just corrodes right away, but not oxygen. Oxygen will actually accumulate in the atmosphere, whereas fluorine and chlorine won't. And so, bottom line, they say there's no other way to get a large release of energy in a chemical reduction reaction except to use oxygen. There's no other candidate in the atomic chart. Nothing comes even close to being stable enough in the atmosphere and yet deliver huge amounts of energy. Then they go on in their paper to say what we're really talking about. And what they point out is that there are life forms here on planet Earth that don't use oxygen to get energy. But those life forms are 10 times less efficient in their metabolic reaction, which means they're 10 times less active than the aerobic life forms. And it really explains why when you're dealing with anaerobic life, none of them are any larger than strings of single cells. And so when you're looking at anaerobic life, that's the biggest you can get would be single cells that kind of spring together in the long filaments. So where you get multicellular organization, you have to have oxygen. And so as origin of life researchers, they make the conclusion, if you don't have large amounts of free oxygen, then you can forget about anything beyond bacteria and strings of bacteria. Everything else is simply not going to be possible. Then they get into the technical aspects of the paper, not really that technical, but they calculate how much oxygen you need for different kinds of anaerobes. Anaerobes is a term for life that uses oxygen to get its energy. And what they discovered is that unless you can exceed an oxygen abundance in the atmosphere that's greater than 1,000 pascals, and I'll tell you what that is in a minute, you're not going to get a life form bigger than 1 millimeter across. So we're talking really tiny life unless you get above a certain oxygen level. And a pascal, if you've always wanted to know, equals 1 newton per square meter. That probably helps you out. Okay, 1 newton per square meter is 1 kilogram per square meter per second squared. So what it really is a pressure term, okay? So that probably helps you out. But I'll give you something. No? Well, let me just translate it. What I think really works well, I mean, the whole paper is just using these pascals. But to help you out here, 1,000 pascals equals a little bit less than 1% of the atmospheric pressure we experience at sea level. So, you know, I think you're all told in elementary school that air pressure is about 15 pounds per square inch. Never heard of that? Okay. Okay. Well, 1,000 pascals is about 0.145 pounds per square inch. And so you need a, you know, atmospheric pressure at sea level is a little more than 100,000 pascals. So that's what you're breathing right now. It's a little bit beyond 100,000 pascals worth. Okay. It's impossible to get a life form bigger than a millimeter across because of its energy demand unless the atmosphere has a little bit more than 1% of the oxygen content of our current atmosphere. And if you want something bigger than a centimeter across, then you need an oxygen content that's a little bit more than 10% of our present. Now, if you're talking bodies that are a meter across, then you really need the full 100,000 pascals. And so only with a very rich oxygen, free oxygen abundance in the atmosphere is it possible to have large animals. So their whole point of the paper is to say, if we're going to find life elsewhere in the universe, we're probably not looking at anything more than a bacterium. And even if there is oxygen there, we're probably not looking at anything bigger than a millimeter across, which means they're not going to be making radio telescopes trying to communicate with us. I mean, if you're that tiny, forget it. You're just not going to be able to develop any kind of decent technology. Matter of fact, intellect depends on your body size. You know, people say ants are smart, but no, they're very limited in their intellect. And it's because their body size is just so tiny. You need to get up to a larger body size to make that all possible. Now, the rest of the paper focuses on just how extremely difficult it is to have a planet with that much oxygen on it, as much oxygen as our planet has on it. And in fact, how extraordinarily difficult it is to get a planet with even 1% the oxygen content of our planet. And the only way you can get a lot of free oxygen, you can get about 1/1,000th of the oxygen that our planet Earth has, if you're using non-organic mechanisms to get that oxygen. I'll give you an example. If you have a planet that, like planet Earth, is loaded with uranium and thorium, that uranium and thorium will provide an energy source. There'll be radiation coming out from that thorium and uranium. And as that radiation passes through liquid water, it'll dissociate the hydrogen and the oxygen in the water, and thereby you'll get free oxygen in the atmosphere and free oxygen in the water. And incidentally, that mechanism all by itself is enough to stop any prebiotic chemistry on the face of the Earth. The uranium alone on planet Earth makes it impossible for a naturalistic pathway for the origin of life. Why? Because it releases enough oxygen to put a stop to the prebiotic chemical processes. As any Origin of Life textbook will show you, or you can look in our book, Origins of Life, oxygen is toxic to Origin of Life chemistry. Even the tiniest amount of oxygen will put a stop to that. And the uranium and thorium alone will do that. And so you can get a small amount of oxygen without life. But if you want even 1,000 pascals worth of oxygen in the atmosphere, you're only going to get it through photosynthetic light. You know, cyanobacteria, what we call algae. And the photosynthetic reaction there will be able to take the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and the water from the atmosphere and make sugar and oxygen. That's basically how green plants work. Carbon dioxide and water come in, and then sunlight becomes the energy mechanism whereby they convert that water and carbon dioxide into sugars and oxygen, and that oxygen gets released. And by that means, if there were no oxygen sinks on planet Earth, you'd be able to build up the oxygen quantity in the Earth's atmosphere in a relatively short period of time, thousands of years, a million years of folks. However, the problem with any planet, and especially with a planet like Earth, is it's loaded with oxygen sinks. And you can't get the atmosphere to be oxygen rich until you fill up all the oxygen sinks. And so what do you mean by, pardon me? Okay. What's an oxygen sink? Well, I'll give you an example. Iron is an oxygen sink. Why? Because you put iron and oxygen together, they react and they make rust. Now, you may not notice that living here in Southern California, but for 5.5 years I was in Toronto. And I also lived in Vancouver as a young boy. And, you know, where if you got a lot of rain coming down, you're going to get rust on your cars. And particularly in Toronto, you've got two problems. They have snow in the wintertime, and they have salt. Salt and snow. And by the way, when I lived in Toronto, I never saw cars older than 4 years. After 4 years, they're completely rusted out. Well, there's lots of iron in the Earth. The Earth is, even the Earth's crust is 5% iron. And the interior of the Earth is much richer in iron than that. And so this oxygen is going to react with the iron, which means you're not going to get a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere until all that iron becomes rust. And if you go out and try to mine iron, that's really what you're mining. You're mining rust. But it wasn't rust to start with. The oxygen to combine with. So here's all these cyanobacteria busily producing oxygen, and it's like all the oxygen they produce gets absorbed into this the iron rust. But iron is not the most efficient oxygen sink. Probably phosphorus is. Most of you know that phosphates is a phosphorus atom combined with four oxygen atoms. Iron only combines with two, but phosphorus combines with four. And so when the Earth is really young, the sink that's being filled up first are all the phosphorus sinks. Now, you may hear of things called banded iron deposits or banded iron layers. Those are those beautiful rock layers you see when you go into our national parks in the West. And those banded iron layers you see are a combination of iron and phosphorus absorbing all that oxygen. But there's even a bigger oxygen sink, and it's the entire interior of the Earth. Because Earth has plate tectonics, the crust gets recycled down into the mantle, and the mantle is oxygen poor, it's oxygen starved, and so here's all these cyanobacteria busy producing all this oxygen. They finally get the crust oxygenated, but the crust through plate tectonics gets subducted into the mantle, and then all the oxygen in this air gets robbed by the mantle. Then the mantle gets returned a new crust, and then it gets exposed to the atmosphere, and it gets all oxygenated, and then it goes back down into the interior. So you literally have to oxygenate the entire mantle of the Earth. Now, the mantle goes from the core of the Earth, which is about 1,000 miles above the center, all the way up to about, the 8,000-mile diameter. We're talking, you've got to oxygenate 90% of the volume of planet Earth, which is why it takes so many billions of years for the oxygen abundance of planet Earth to even reach a 10% level. Now, that didn't happen until 500 million years ago, where all these photosynthetic bacterial life forms pumped enough oxygen out that they filled up enough of the interior of the mantle with oxygen that now the atmosphere could start to accumulate some oxygen. And then there was more oxygen sinks that had to be filled. And really, it wasn't until 200 million years ago that the oxygen abundance even reached 17% of total atmospheric abundance. So if you want to know why we have the Cambrian explosion not happening until 540 million years ago, that's the first time the oxygen abundance hit 10% of the total air in the atmosphere. And that made possible for the first time animals that were, say, 10 centimeters across, or even 20 centimeters across. You could have creatures that big. But not until 250 million years ago, when the oxygen content reached 17% for the first time, was it possible of animals as big as dinosaurs. So if you want to know why it was so late in the history of planet Earth before you get anything big, that's because the oxygen simply wasn't available. Now, the dinosaurs are huge. However, they're endothermic rather than ectothermic, which means they have a low metabolism. And it wasn't until the oxygen content hit 20% that it was possible to have big birds and big mammals. So that again explains why we don't see big birds and big mammals until about 140 million years ago. 140 million years ago is when the oxygen content finally reaches a point where those creatures are possible. The oxygen content today is 21%. And this is why we can have large mammals, large birds, why we can have human beings. We wouldn't be able to exist unless that oxygen had been there. And you say, well, can't we just push stuff a little bit more and then we can have people that are 30 feet tall? Well, there are other limits. If you push the oxygen content even up to 23% rather than the 21% we have today, and there was a time in the past history of the Earth where it did hit 23%, only one time where it hit that high. But if it were to hit that high today, we would have uncontrollable forest and grass fires. You say, well, how come we got away with it in the past? Well, the one epoch where we had 23% was an extremely wet epoch. So it was very high humidity, and that's what kept the forests and grass fires in check. But the problem with that high humidity is it traps heat from the sun. And now that the sun is brighter than it was at that episode in the past, it's important that we don't have that high of a humidity. And with a lower humidity, you need to drop the oxygen content down to about 21%. So that meant eliminating a lot of photosynthetic life to make that possible and putting life on planet Earth that would consume lots of oxygen. Yes. Hey, the treats have arrived. And you will not offend me if you get up and go back there and get treats. In fact, you won't offend me if you go back and get treats three or four times. So feel free to do that. Oh, no. At the beginning of the Cameron explosion, it was about 15 to 16%. And not until it got up to about 17 or 18% could you have big creatures like dinosaurs. So in the Cameron explosion, the biggest animal you have is a little less than a meter across, and it's kind of like a, well, it's these trilobites. And, you know, they got the shells. They're kind of like a big, what's that expensive dish you get at the seafood store? Lobster, that's it. That's probably the best thing. You know, think of a giant lobster. And if you've ever seen lobsters, if you're out there swimming, they don't move very fast. And so they're low metabolism creatures. And that's why you get something that big, even with an oxygen content is only 15 or 16%. Pardon me? So how do we... Well, we have the geologic record where we can kind of date when all these creatures existed on the face of the Earth. Oh, no. I mean, you've got a good point. In fact, somebody critiqued my latest book, Creation of Science. Some scientist wrote in and said, you know, I don't like your chart on the oxygenation of planet Earth. And I had to send him a quick note back saying, well, this was all discovered in the last 6 months. And it's done through isotope measures. And to really get a good handle on how much oxygen the Earth had at a particular time, you need good radiometric dates, and then you need these isotope ratios. And isotope ratios that would have a different response, one isotope compared to another relative to oxygen. Yeah, it's in the geologic column. So you can make a core drill, and you pick out a little layer there, and then you look for these isotopes, and the isotopes, as I say, will react to different amounts of oxygen. And what you really want to do is get three or four families of isotopes. Now, this is all kind of above you. What I'm talking about is where you pick an element, like neodymium, and it's... sorry. Well, samarium is another one. It's not a Samaritan, it's a samarium, okay? And what you do is you get two different isotopes of this element, and what you notice is that one isotope is a little more effective at reacting with oxygen than the other isotope. And if you get three of these pairs, say samarium and neodymium and a sulfur, I think you all heard of sulfur, okay? All right. Not as good as the neodymium or samarium for making these kinds of measurements. But the whole point is, if you've got three different pairs, it's like your algebra class, where you've got three equations and three unknowns. You can solve the equations, and you can figure out how much oxygen must have existed at that time with a considerable amount of precision. But the problem is it has only been done recently that we can actually get an accurate record of the oxygenation of the planet, which is what stimulated this paper, saying now that we know the oxygenation history of planet Earth in some detail, how can we explain this from a naturalistic perspective? And these four scientists find themselves, these are all scientists at NASA, and they're finding themselves extraordinarily challenged to try to explain how this could happen in such a short period of time. And what they mean by short period of time is saying this only happened in 3.9 billion years. And, you know, they're amazed that it could happen that fast. And but then they close the paper off by saying, if it doesn't happen that fast, there is no possibility for advanced life. Why? Because the sun in the future will be going into a burning phase that will not be suitable for advanced life. It's going to become unstable. It's going to start flaring. There's going to be more X-rays coming out, more particle radiation coming out, and also it's going to be a lot hotter than it is today. And so the whole point is you've got to make it happen in 3.9 billion years, because you wait any longer than that, then the sun simply won't be in a condition that will support advanced life. And the paper concludes by saying, what an incredible coincidence all this must be. The fact that it's extraordinarily challenging to explain how this could happen so extremely rapidly, and yet if it doesn't happen extremely rapidly, then there's no possibility for advanced life because the sun simply won't be in a stable enough condition. The paper also deals with the obvious challenge and say, well, why don't we go with a star that is simply a longer burning than the sun? Won't that give us more time? But the problem with going with a longer burning sun or longer burning star is that those longer burning stars are far more unstable than the sun is. The sun is in an interesting mass peak. If you make it any more massive, it burns up more rapidly and is more unstable. And if you make it any less massive, it burns more slowly, but it's much more unstable than the stars that are more massive than the sun. So the bottom line is, if you want advanced life, you must go with a star that's exactly the mass of the sun. And I think I reported on this about 5 months ago here in the class, that astronomers have been trying to find what they call a perfect solar twin by looking at other stars, and they haven't found any yet. Even though there's hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy, we're not able to find any true solar twins. Stars that are the same age, the same mass, the same spectral characteristics as the sun, and therefore capable of supporting advanced life. Which means, bottom line, this has got to be a miracle to explain why our planet has so much oxygen and why it gets it so rapidly. So, question. Sometimes, not all the time. When you look at these fine-tuned parameters, some of them are independent of one another. Let me give you an example. One condition for life on planet Earth, as I've mentioned, is that the sun must be a particular mass. A second condition is that the planet must be a certain precise distance from that planet. The distance of the planet from the star is independent, has got nothing to do with the mass of the star. So those are independent parameters. So the fine-tuning probability for getting the right distance is independent of the fine-tuning probability of getting the right mass. So if you want the probability for both being there at the same time, you must multiply the probability for one with the probability for the other. And if you're dealing with several hundred independent parameters, you wind up with an extremely tiny possibility, which allows you to say this can't be an accident or coincidence. This must be supernatural design. And you say, well, how tiny of a probability does it have to be? Well, you know, there are some scientists who've made an extremely conservative estimate of what qualifies as a miracle. And they say, well, let's just take all the protons and neutrons in the universe. How many is that? 10 to the 80th. Okay. And how old is the universe? Well, 10 to the 17 seconds. And how many reactions could you have per second? Well, the tiniest moment of time in which a reaction is possible is called the Planck time. which is 10 to the 46 seconds, 10 to the minus 46 seconds. So you multiply all those together, and which gives you a probability of one chance in 10 to the 150th. So if it's less than one chance in 10 to the 150th, it's impossible for that to happen by natural process. Although most physicists, every physicist I know of, would say that's ridiculously conservative, because we don't see any reactions that would all be significant to life that take place at 10 to the 46 times per second. That just, I mean, nowhere do you see that. That only happens at the subatomic level, which is completely immaterial to the kinds of questions we're talking about. And therefore, they would argue that if you can find something with a probability of less than one chance in 10 to the 50th, it's not natural. That's the signature for supernatural superintelligent design. But you're absolutely right. There are characteristics that are dependent, in which case we can't just simply multiply them together. We have to take into account the dependency factors. Let me see if I can give you an example of that. Right. You could say, well, a star's got to be a certain brightness in order for life to be possible, but the brightness of the star to some degree depends on the mass of the star. And so it's not really fair physics to say, well, we're going to multiply the probability of getting a star at the right brightness for the probability of getting the star at the right mass. Those are dependent. Now, they're not strictly dependent, where one cancels out the other, because there are other factors that affect the luminosity in addition to the mass, but in that case, you need to take into account what are called the dependency factors. Which is why, when you go to our website, what you'll notice is that we have these tables of all these design characteristics, and we do take into account the dependency factors. And where we're not able to calculate those dependency factors with any kind of precision, we just take a very conservative estimate. We try to be as generous as possible to those who want to promote an atheist perspective. But anyway, interesting paper written by a bunch of non-theistic scientists at NASA who are part of this astrobiology program to find life elsewhere in the universe. And they say, well, very conservatively, if we're going to find life elsewhere in the universe, it's not going to be trilobites, it's not going to be dinosaurs, it's not going to be primates. We're probably talking tiny cells. And actually, if truth be told, it's not that easy to get the tiny cells, because there's no pathway to originate the tiny cells, or you're not going to get oxygen to put a stop to it. Okay, one question, then we'll go on to our lesson. Yeah. Which one? I'd probably say get the new one, Creation of Science, or get the book Origins of Life. One of those two would be good to deal with that one. And you know, as far as your Hollywood expert goes, I'm guessing he got that probably from Carl Sagan, or that guy who's been on in Hollywood a lot is Frank Drake. And it's called the Drake Equation, where you say, well, we have a universe with lots and lots of stars, and let's just assume all those stars have planets. And let's assume that one in ten of those stars with planets has a planet that's like planet Earth. And let's assume that one in ten of the planets that are like Earth would have primitive life on it. And that one planet in ten with primitive life on it would have advanced life on it. And one planet in ten with advanced life on it would have life as technologically advanced as we are. Therefore, let's go see if we can see their radio and TV signals that they're broadcasting out throughout the galaxy. And you say, well, why did they come up with that 1 in 10? Well, Carl Sagan, in his book that he wrote in 1962 with Josef Sklovsky, the Russian guy who really got this whole idea going that there's life everywhere in the universe, said, well, we really haven't got the scientific tools to pin down these probabilities. So let's just pick 1 out of 10. That seems reasonable. You say, where did they get that from? Well, where they got that from is they said, our solar system has, to one order of magnitude, 10 planets. And one of those 10 of those planets has life on it. Therefore, 1/10 sounds like a good probability to use all the way down the line. Now, the problem with your Hollywood expert is that he's still stuck back in 1962, And by the way, I shouldn't pick on the Hollywood expert. Every high school biology textbook that I own in my office tells the same story. Even those textbooks that have been written in the 21st century. Now, and the other part of the story is Carl Sagan's explanation of the origin of life. He says, we have this planet. It's a big planet with lots of water on it. Let's just presume that all that water is loaded with prebiotic molecules at the beginning of life here on planet Earth. And we have this huge ocean on planet Earth loaded up with prebiotic molecules, amino acids, sugars, and nucleotides. And let's just presume it cooks under the heat of the sun for a billion years. He said, with a billion years and all those prebiotics, random chemistry is going to make us a simple life form from which we all evolve. But as you can see in our book, Origins of Life, there's a couple of problems with that story from Carl Sagan. We now have, I'm trying to use a strong word here, conclusive evidence that planet Earth never had a primordial soup. And I already shared you with some of that evidence. We have conclusive evidence that there is uranium on the early Earth, more uranium than there is now, in addition to thorium and radioactive potassium. And that radiation alone is enough to guarantee there's too much oxygen in the Earth's environment for there to be any prebiotics on planet Earth. Number two, we've looked for the prebiotics and they're not there. The prebiotics would have a different carbon-12 to carbon-13 ratio. There's your isotopes, okay? Life likes carbon-12 and hates carbon-13. So if you've got an organic reaction going on, it's going to produce more carbon-12 in its carbon than carbon-13. Non-organic mechanism, which is your prebiotic chemistry, will be the other way around. And we look in the core, and we do these core drills and look at ancient rocks, we don't see any of the signatures for prebiotic chemistry. But for good reason. Oxygen would prevent that from happening. And number two, we know there's no time. I won't go into the details, but there's the event that took place in the past history of the Earth that turned the whole surface of the Earth into molten lava at least 200 kilometers deep and at a temperature that exceeded 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit. Obviously, that would break up any possible prebiotic molecules. And what we notice is immediately after the termination of that event, we have abundant life on planet Earth, which means the origin of life took place in a geologic instant without the benefit of a primordial soup. So next time you bump into your Hollywood origin of life expert, you can share that with him. How do you explain all this if there's no time and no soup? Mark. A primordial haze? Yes, and it's based on the research that's been taking place on Titan, because Titan has what's called an organic haze. It's loaded with what they call organic molecules. But be careful when you hear that term organic molecule. When these scientists talk about organic molecules, they really don't mean proteins and a DNA and RNA. That those would be true organic molecules. In fact, they don't even mean amino acids and sugars and nucleotides, the building blocks. What they're talking about are the building blocks of the building blocks. Things like carbon dioxide, hydrogen cyanide, which is HCN, just three molecules, ammonia, methane, hydrogen. These are what they call organic molecules. And it is true that Titan's atmosphere is loaded with organic molecules, the kind of organic molecules that typifies Los Angeles smog. Okay, it looks brown, looks yellow, whatever, and is loaded with things like formaldehyde and all these cyanides and things like that. However, the thing that astronomers have noticed with this Cassini mission is that the Titan atmosphere is missing two very critical, what you would call the building blocks of the building blocks. It's missing water, and it's missing ammonia. And if you have no ammonia and no water, you're not going to get the nucleotides that are going to make possible DNA and RNA. That's missing. Likewise, the same studies on planet Earth indicate that the early Earth may have had brief episodes where it had an atmosphere akin to some of the characteristics of Titan. But likewise, it would have been missing the ammonia. Yes. Okay, as far as your science fiction movies and stories about non-carbon-based life, we kind of throw a lot of cold water on that in our book Origins of Life. And this is something that is now universally accepted by the scientific community. You're not going to get physicists unless you make them out of carbon. There's just no other option. And the problem is that 30, 40 years ago, people were looking at boron and silicon. And chemically, boron and silicon are like carbon. You can make a lot of complex bonds. But neither boron or silicon are as stable as carbon. And carbon will bind with almost anything. Silicon will bind with a lot of stuff, but not as much as carbon. But the real problem is that if you were to make a protein out of, say, silicon, you can't make it any longer than 100 amino acids before it falls apart. And even the ones that are only 20 amino acids long don't last long. They have a short lifespan. And so we now realize you're not going to make life out of silicon. Boron has not been researched to the same degree as silicon. There's a good reason. We also recognize that boron is toxic to many life, especially animal life. Plants seem to be able to handle a fair amount of boron, but not animals. Now, I know some of you take these little boron supplements. You really don't need them. Boron is a favorite of the diet industry these days because it stimulates your metabolism. At least that's what they think it does. There's no proof that it really stimulates metabolism, but it has found its way into the diet pill industry. And you can take my word for it as a scientist. There are better ways to lose weight than taking boron pills. And if you take too many, it will prove toxic. Yes. You never took it. All right. You took it for other reasons. No, I mean, that's the story, is that it stimulates various metabolic reactions. But the bottom line is there's no real proof that it actually does stimulate these metabolic reactions. So, yes. Well, I mean, that for sure we know is toxic. Because it's radioactive. Yeah. Anything that's radioactive, I'd be very careful about how much you ingest. So. Right. Well, you can handle it in different ways. You know, people who want to kill someone by that means, there's quite a number of radioactive isotopes you can get that'll do the job. I mean, one of the more popular ones is... No, I'll tell you the one that's used more... It's one that's used in cancer research, at cobalt-60. And the whole point is that the medical industry... sometimes is a little bit careless about disposing of these cobalt-60 cancer treatment things, and so there'll be a little bit of cobalt-60 left. People pick it up, and they use it for nefarious purposes. Polonium's a little more difficult to obtain, but it can be done. Whereas uranium and plutonium tend to be under strict government supervision. So although if you want to get uranium, you can go to old mines in Utah and get it there. However, the problem is you'll probably do yourself considerable damage just trying to mine the stuff. So, yes, Steve. Yeah, let's get into the Bible active stuff. Thank you. Let's do that. Okay. Last week we got started on... Oh, wait a minute. I need to get into my PowerPoint here. Let's... There we go. All right, I'm just going to... Oh, boy. What happened here? All right, I think they're in business. Here we go. Can you read quickly? Actually, these verses I'm going through, we're going to need for today's study. So I'll give you a quick chance to read them all real quick. Okay? Now, we've been studying this for weeks, though, so you must have all these verses memorized by now. So I'll just get you through them quickly. Because, yeah, I got some questions I'm going to pull on you. All right? But let's get ourselves back up to Romans 1. What may be known about God is plain to them. God's invisible qualities have been clearly seen, being understood by what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And this is just Romans 1, 18 through 20. And last week we got into the remainder of Romans 1, verses 21 down to 32. We had Don read the passage for us in his very eloquent voice. And it's quite a surprise just to see what the consequences are for those who decide to deny that God really is the one responsible for everything we see in the record of nature. And so what I thought we would do today is actually go through this passage and look at what happens to people who persist in denying God, the existence of God, and God's involvement in the record of nature. What may be known about God is plain to them. And, you know, we've been studying lots of verses in the Old Testament and now the New Testament that really emphasize just how clearly and directly God reveals himself and his work through the record of nature. It's like you really got to be blind not to see this overwhelming evidence that's out there. Well, this is a passage that helps us to explain why it is there's so many people here on planet Earth that can't seem to recognize this obvious declaration of God through the record of nature. What is it that causes them not to see? God's invisible qualities, what's part of it? He's invisible. A lot of people only believe that which they can see. But it has been understood from what has been made. So the invisible is clear and obvious from what is visible, so that men are without excuse. But, verse 21, for although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to them, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. And basically what we have here in Romans 1, 21 to 32 is three or four paragraphs, but there's really three themes. And what I want to do is take us into those three themes and ask you a bunch of questions. So here's theme number one. When you're committed to deny God and God's involvement, one of the things that happens to you is that you become an impaired scientist. Now, by the way, I want to use that term generically, because that's how Romans 1 uses it. It says this is obvious to everyone. So what Romans 1 is telling us, and it's the same theme we see in the book of Job, every human being is a scientist. We're all scientists. Some of us get paid to do the science. Some of us take advanced courses in science, but every human being is a scientist. And God holds every human being responsible to be a good scientist. Well, and we're a scientist, that's what a scientist does. A scientist studies the record of nature and tries to learn how that record of nature works and operates, what's behind it, how it works, why it works the way it does. And in that sense, God holds every one of us responsible to be a scientist. However, when you're on this path of denying God, there are certain things that will impair your ability to look at the record of nature and gain the truth from the record of nature. That's probably a simpler definition of a scientist. You examine or observe the record of nature, and from your observations, you discern truth. Okay, so we're all called an account to look at the record of nature and to garner truth from that record of nature. Okay, but someone who's committed to deny God is going to find himself or herself impaired. How so? Well, I've got a list here of 10 things on my PowerPoint, 9 things. And I'm convinced that my list is quite limited and impaired. so I'm counting on you to help me fill it out. So, but some basic consequences. But tell you what, I'll get you started and see if you can pick up on this. It always makes it easier, I think, if I do that for you. One of the ways you're going to be impaired is you'll overlook the obvious. If you're not willing to credit God for what you see in the wreck of nature, there's certain things you simply will not see. You'll overlook that. And you'll fail to see connections. You won't be able to connect what you're seeing, say, in physics with what you're seeing in anthropology, what you're seeing in sociology. And number three, you're going to start focusing on what you think are the evils or the bad things in nature rather than... Non-theistic perspective, denying that God was responsible for the human body and identified all kinds of bad designs in the human body. Whereas today, with a little deeper understanding, we're recognizing that we had misidentified those bad designs, which turned out to be elegant designs. The example we gave you last week was the appendix. How it was routine 40, 50 years ago, if you had an abdominal surgery, they would remove your appendix because they presumed it was completely useless. Well, it was useless for digestion, but it wasn't useless. We now realize the appendix serves an important role, a critical role, in the human immune response system. Therefore, I'd advise all of you, don't get rid of your appendix unless it's really going to be threatening your life. And then you want to get rid of it. But it's a good thing to have. And likewise, that little S in our backbone and the tailbone we have isn't a holdover from our evolution from monkeys. It's actually something that enables us in a unique way, unique compared to all the other animals, to not only be able to stand for long periods of time, to sleep for long periods of time, to run for long periods of time, but to sit behind a computer desk for long periods of time. Now, it's interesting. I think the Creator anticipated there would come a day in the future when we would be sitting behind the desk for hours at a time and gave us a backbone so we could do that and run and walk and sleep and stand for long periods of time. Now, overlooking the obvious, we have an example in our book, Who is Adam? Where for 35 years, biochemists overlooked what they thought, what they called junk DNA. They presumed that only 3% of the genome of all advanced creatures served any purpose, and the other 97% was total junk. And it was kind of like the appendix. They were only looking for purpose and design in one area. And, 3% of the genome provides a code that will tell you how to manufacture the proteins. The other 97% serves very different purposes. But for 35 years, the presumption was it served no purpose at all. And, by the way, it wasn't biochemists who figured it out. It was a bunch of physicists. who were interested in testing a computer program that can analyze language complexity. And they decided, as a fun experiment, to apply it to the genomes of these advanced animals, and were shocked to discover that it showed more complexity and purpose in the junk part than what they called the non-junk part. And there again is an interesting thing, is that often you have people who can't see the connection between computer science research, mathematics, and basic biology, failing to see the connections, focusing on the bad designs rather than the design elegance. I think you can come up with a lot more examples. Those are three. Can you give me some more? Yeah, Kathy. Right. Well, it was Albert Einstein, who was not a Christian, but he was a believer in God, who made the comment that the Creator seems to be able to be extremely efficient at the way he makes different aspects of the record of nature work in multiple different directions. And the problem is, if you're not looking for the connections because of your belief in God, all you go down is one pathway. You only look at one possible reason why the record would look the way it does. Incidentally, all these books we've been talking about that are strongly promoting atheism, they're all based on this idea, this illusion. And we look at the record of nature, we see this progression from simple life to complex life. Therefore, they presume there's some simple process in record of nature, like the ecosystem, like competition, survival of the fittest, that's driving that change. They're overlooking the fact that there could be other very good reasons, better reasons, why we see that pattern. The problem is those better reasons require the recognition that there's a God that's behind it all, that actually knows the future and sees what's going to happen and prepares life accordingly. Yes. Right. By the way, this is not in order. I just threw this all down. Right. Well, in that sense, I think it's like number one. You overlook the obvious because you make presumptions. And you only go down one path. You're not willing to look outside the box. And the whole point is, if you believe in God, you realize that God is going to be extremely efficient and elegant in his designs. And he's probably going to use a design in many different ways. He optimizes that design. Therefore, someone who believes in God is going to say, you know what? Given just how God's character is revealed in nature, I'm going to look for the things beyond the obvious. To me, that's another way to do it. You're so focused on the obvious, you can't see the other things that are out there, which could be much more important in a bet. Very good. Yeah. All you do is talk to your friends or fellow atheists. So that's one thing I appreciate about my peers who are Christians. They make it a point to talk to people who take a very different philosophical perspective just to see if they're overlooking something. But I don't often see that kind of thing returned, where the atheists seek out the Christians to get a different perspective on issues. Like, hey, you know, I know everything. I don't need to go down that path. Yes. Right. Well, okay, overlooking the obvious. Let's see, men have an appendix as well as women. If you're going to claim the appendix only serves a purpose to protect the woman and the child in childbirth, how come all of us men have an appendix? Why would evolution give us men an appendix when we don't need it? Maybe there's something else going on we're not seeing. And that's kind of the attitude I'm trying to get at, this whole idea. You know, God is just incredibly wise, and we don't know everything. We only have a piece of the knowledge. And therefore, a scientist who is a theist is going to be committed to try to find out a lot more than he thinks he needs to know. There's a certain humility that comes out of that. And therefore, you begin to look for things. And I would argue that even now, we don't understand all the benefits of the appendix. We've discovered a lot. There's more to discover. And that's a principle we saw when we were looking at Habakkuk, is that there's always more of God's glory and righteousness to discover as you examine the record of nature. We're not done. We don't understand any aspect of the record of nature to a complete degree. Our knowledge is always incomplete. But the one who doesn't believe in God will often be tempted to think, we got this all. We understand it totally. There's no need for any dispute or discussion on this matter. And I think I've heard that kind of talk in curriculum development for high school. We got this all figured out. Don't bother us with alternate viewpoints or understandings on this issue. We have complete understanding on this. Let's not confuse the kids. Okay, you're next, and then... Well, that's why I like the term unified field theory, because what you're really claiming is that if we look at physics on the particle scale, we're going to find a unifying principle, which is what you'd expect if there's a single creator responsible for it all. But the theory of everything gives the idea that the human scientist is going to be able to figure out the whole story. Well, now that is a term that's used in the scientific literature. They call this unified field theory the TOE theory. T-O-E, the theory of everything. And then you've got people like Stephen Hawking who say it's not only a theory of everything for physics, it's a theory of everything for everything. He actually believes that we're on the pathway of finding mathematical principles that will actually enable us to see the future, predict the future with precision, and as he puts it, gain the mind of God. We'll know everything that God knows. Well, this book has got something to say about that. We're not going to know anything that God knows. Even when we get to the new creation, we're not going to know anything that God knows. I think you're next, and you, then we'll get back here. Well, I didn't know when it was going to be on. It was taped. Nick Matsky. He's at the National Center for Science Education, which is the premier organization in the world attacking those who believe in creation, although they promote themselves as an organization that promotes evolution education, but really it's an anti-creationist organization. Yeah, we're all biased. The question is your bias right or wrong? So, well, we're going to post that on our website in its entirety. And Michael said he wanted round two, so we'll see what happens. Okay, if I know. Steve. Definitely, and Fuzz and I got to see that firsthand at two Origin of Life research conferences. And here they're facing this incredible conundrum of trying to explain the origin of life without time and without any prebiotics. But you know, how they start off is they say, well, one thing we all know for sure, non-negotiable, God wasn't involved in this. Given that there's no God here, how are we going to explain this huge problem we got from a naturalistic perspective? And so right away, there's that presumption there, which is causing them to overlook the obvious, fail to see the connections, and focus on the bad designs rather than a design elegance. You're right on target. And let's see, you or someone over right here. Yep. Very good, which is why we have to put it to the test. Check it out and see. Well, I mean, her comment is that there's often an authority problem here. Carl Sagan's on TV, he says it. I'm on TV, I say it. And, there isn't the adequate questioning of the person that's bringing. And by the way, one thing we're going to get down to here is that people who deny God have an authority problem. Right. Well, that's what Nick Matsky said to me. He says, because I'm a Christian, I can't be doing good science. Right. Right. That's right. Right. Which is why in that debate on the MedVed show, I said, well, who cares about the bias? We need to test the bias. Put it to the test. Let's look at the prediction, see what happens. So, it was an hour-long show, so, which is still way too short for that kind of a debate. Way too short. Well, that's it. I mean, you get 35 minutes of commercials, 25 minutes of content. So, although it wasn't quite that bad in the Michael Medved show. It felt like it, eh? Okay. Right. Right. Yeah. Right. I think that's most common when the underlying presumption is not even stated. And I see that a lot in the scientific literature where, from a Christian perspective, you read the paper and you can see the bias, but the bias is never confessed. And that's particularly true of biology research papers. It's less true in the physics and the mathematics. Well, I've got a few more here. This is right out of the text, right? The text tells us that one of the things they do in denying God is they exchange the glory of the immortal for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. They elevate the status of men, animals, Mother Earth, the cosmos. What was Carl Sagan's opening statement? The cosmos is all there is or was or will be. What he basically did is he took the universe and turned it into a god, saying that's all there is, that's where we came from. We see a lot going on in the 21st century on trying to look at the animals and elevate them to almost a human status. And by the way, when you see that done, where you've got these eco-scientists looking at the animals and making them much more than they are, trying to claim they have human attributes, at the same time, they're elevating humanity, where we become the highest life form that there is. So it's not just an elevation of the animals, it's the elevation of men. Now, here in the text, it talks about people at that time 2,000 years ago exchanging the glory of the immortal God for images, statues, icons, idols. And I think today in the 21st century, we're a lot more subtle in the way we build our idols. Any comments? I mean, you don't see scientists, building a statue and bowing down and worshiping before that statue three times a day. But they do other things that are equivalent. Yes, Steve. Right. Yeah. You know, the car is for transportation, but it can become an idol. So, but I'm not trying to get down on people who buy fancy cars, because there are people who buy fancy other things, right? To gain what? Status. Yeah. Everybody call it status symbols? In the old days, you used to call them idols. Now we call them status symbols. Okay. But there are even more subtle ways. See, a class like this, go ahead. Yeah, where you spend your time. Right. Okay, you're next. Well, there's enough evidence, because what we see in nature is very impressive. And so there's that tendency to say, wow, this is really great. Or to look at yourself and say, boy, I'm really great. It's real easy for us to do that as human beings. I mean, I saw that at Caltech all the time. These scientists looking at themselves and saying, boy, I'm really smart. Well, they are really smart, but maybe they're elevating that to a higher degree than they should. I often had to remind these guys who are much smarter than I was to say, well, you know, where did you get that intellect from? Maybe you should thank your parents, or maybe God that was responsible for your parents, but instead they take credit for their own intellect. And the bottom line is, not one of us in this classroom had anything to do with the intelligence that we manifest. Zero. But we tend to take credit. Hey, by the way, we're out of time. And I got some more here. But the fun thing is, we're going to get to not just a science impairment. We got several more impairments. The next one is our impaired ability to love. And what's fun about looking at our impaired ability to love, it's basically the same path as we get with the science stuff. Okay, we overlook the obvious. We fail to see connections. So when we get down to what's going on with intimacy impairments, we go down the same path. And I hope my wife is listening to this. What this really means is, to be a good lover, you've got to be a good scientist, all right? You can think about that while you go out to lunch. But remember, we're all scientists. And we're all good scientists, we'll all be good lovers, right? All right. Father in heaven, we thank you that you did create us very different from the animals. Lord, you created us to be a scientist. You created us to love. You created us to think. And Father, help us to understand just how special we are in your eyes. But Lord, I pray you would use our thinking ability, our loving ability, our science ability to bring glory to you and to see your glory and righteousness revealed in the record of nature. And Father, as we go about our work, as we go about our recreation, our time with our family, help us by your Spirit to see those opportunities whereby we can guide people past their blindness to see the light that you reveal. And may that light penetrate their hearts into salvation. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you. Well, I told him we do round two.